Welcome to the realm of heroes and monsters. Storytime with your host, A.P. Fuchs. Stories of intrigue, stories of horror, stories of superheroics, stories of monsters. Get ready, the thrill ride begins.
Welcome to the latest episode of the realm of heroes and monsters, Storytime with your host, me, A.P. Fuchs. So, if you're doing the listen-watch version of this podcast on YouTube, you will see in the background we are sitting amongst a pile of awesome pop culture collectibles because we are doing something today just a little bit different called, I call it my corner side podcast, if you will. I'm on the corner of the couch and I got my stuff behind me. And normally the stuff is recorded in the bunker, but yeah, today we're doing it a little bit different. So yeah, if you're doing the listen-watch version, good. You get to see the cool stuff in the background. I'll even lift the camera for you, show you some of that awesome stuff, right? This is all the reason why, too, if you're listening to this podcast elsewhere, you got to subscribe to the YouTube channel because you get to see fun, awesome things. Now, we're about to hear a story, an old story, one from long ago, and one that I would argue was inspired by Rob Zombie's Living Dead Girl music video. You'll get what I mean when you hear the story. So without further ado, I present to you the Theater of Skulls. Theater of Skulls. Driving through the streets of Winnipeg carried the same monotonous tone as a consistently busy phone line. Same streets, same people, same middle fingers. Gloria Ryler hated it, but she didn't have a choice. She had to take her two boys to her mother's house on the other side of the city so she could go on a string of errands and meet up with a friend for coffee later on. And ever since construction season began, she hadn't been able to take her usual route, over the Chief Peguis Bridge, down Main Street, turning right to get to the suburbs. Instead, she was forced to make a detour which, after driving the Disraeli Bridge and getting onto Main Street, made her double back, then turn left into the burbs. Despite all challenges and frustration, it had to be done. Oma, German for grandmother, was always happy her two grandsons, Keith, age 4, and Alex, 2, could come and visit. Sometimes Gloria caught herself wondering if Oma loved Keith and Alex more than she loved her when she was a child. It didn't matter. At least Oma was willing to sacrifice 3 evenings a week to watch the kids so Gloria could have some semblance of a real life. In fact, the 3 evenings Gloria did this were the highlights of her week. She also knew it was the highlight of her mother's as well. Gloria's thoughts were interrupted when a horrible screech ripped through the car's interior. It was Keith. Gloria peeked into the rearview mirror. "Ah!" Keith yelped, ripping Alex's hand from his golden curls. "What's going on back there?" Gloria put her eyes back toward the road, returning the vehicle to center lane. "Alex keeps pulling my hair, Mom," Keith said. "Alex, leave your brother alone." Alex's hands snapped back to his lap. In the rearview mirror, Gloria saw him look at her, mouth drooped to the sides, his way of apologizing. She continued driving. After 4 years with kids and 2 of those years spent with Alex, adding to the weight of parenthood, she had pretty much grown immune to frustration and impatience. But, like all mothers would tell you, one shirt could only get stretched so thin. Gloria turned onto Main and habitually locked the doors as she drove through the north end of town. You can never be too safe, especially out here. The road was blocked up ahead with a barricade of orange and black signs, telling that construction hell was about to break loose. An arrow on one of those signs said to take a left and travel down the street that ran parallel to Main. With a sneer, Gloria turned and took yet another detour. "Are we there yet?" came Keith. "Are we there yet?" Alex asked. "Almost, honey," she said. Finding the street she needed, Gloria slumped her shoulders and gave herself a moment to relax. Traffic and bloody construction always got her worked up. It suddenly grew dark inside the car. Nothing felt right. At first the world outside appeared the same, but when Gloria slowed to search out the source of the giant shadow, she saw everything around her had changed. She was still downtown, on the detour street, but she didn't know where she was. The buildings looked as if someone had dumped bags of sawdust and dirt on them. Blotches of what looked like melting tar were speckled against the bricks, the windows fogged with either smoke or steam. She stopped the car and noticed everyone else who had been driving beside her had disappeared. "Why have you stopped?" Keith asked. "Mommy just wants to stop and look around," she said as comfortably as possible. She wished someone would comfort her. There was an alley adjacent to the street she was on. In it, a swarming tribe of homeless people milled about. Some were sleeping on broken mattresses, others in rusted cars with half the parts missing, some just treating the muddy pavement as a bed. Gloria looked through the window on the passenger side and saw the same thing. More people, more debris, more hopelessness. Straining her neck so she could see better out of her window, she noticed the sky had also changed, turning an ashen gray instead of a normal blue. The clouds seemed to be melting off the sky. Alex began to cry. "Shut up, you baby," Keith told him and gave him repeated jabs with his elbow. "Keith," Gloria said and unbuckled her seatbelt. Keith immediately stopped. His head sank into his shoulders. Though only a boy, he, too, seemed to feel the shadows start to penetrate him. Gloria paused and placed both palms on the steering wheel, trying to determine what she should do and precisely where they were. "Okay," she thought. We were driving along and boom, out of nowhere, a cloud of darkness settles and everything around us changed into some sort of slum. Alex cried louder. "Shh, honey, it's okay," she said, turning to Alex and patting him on the thigh. "Mom, I'm scared," Keith said. "I know, dear." All three of them jumped when an awful banging thundered throughout the vehicle, causing all sides to vibrate. Gloria looked out the windshield. A disheveled man banged a squeegee against the hood of her car. Once, twice, three times. As if sensing her gaze, he jerked around and faced some of what she presumed to be his friends in the alley opposite to them. He pointed at the car and shouted something. Something Gloria couldn't quite make out. "What's he doing, Mom?" Keith asked. "What's he doing, Ma?" Alex asked. "I don't know." She tried to start the car again. The engine wouldn't turn over. She pumped the gas and again turned the key. Nothing. The squeegee man pressed his face against the driver's side window with a thud. Keith and Alex yelped. The squeegee man's filthy skin let the film of gray upon the glass. Then he smiled, displaying a mouth with only three crooked yellow teeth. He let out a cackle. There was another thud, this time coming from the roof of the car. Someone was on top of it. The boys kept yelling and crying. Gloria didn't know what to do. Should she leave the boys and try to ward off the pugs who were wreaking havoc on the car? Panic set in. Like a bear protecting her cubs, Gloria thrust her door open, knocking the squeegee man off balance. She hit the power locks and closed the door all within an instant. Her kids would be safe. The squeegee man was on the pavement. For his size, he seemed to have the stability of a coat rack and couldn't hold himself up properly. Gloria remembered something had landed on the roof of the car. Turning around to see what or who it was, she saw a black man doing a tap dance on her roof. "Get off!" she shouted, her fist banging against the roof. The man only sneered at her and looked down at his new dance floor, increasing the speed and aggression of his tap-tap-tapping. Inside the car, Keith and Alex screamed as the whole vehicle began to wobble from side to side. The driver's side window smashed, catching Gloria off guard. A second later, the squeegee man grabbed her from behind, putting an arm across her throat. Her boys unbuckled and banged on the back seat glass in a seeming effort to somehow scare the stranger away from their mother. The squeegee man laughed. The black man came down off the roof and rammed his elbow against the back seat window. The sound of his elbow against the glass sent a dull clunk through Gloria's chest as he did. The black man appeared to be much stronger than the squeegee man. "Oh no," she thought, acknowledging the man was trying to get to her children. "Stirp," Gloria gasped, her voice a garbled mess. What she meant was, "Stop." The black man continued his assault on the window. Keith and Alex backed into the far door. Gloria stepped on the squeegee man's foot, causing him to lose his grip. She faced him and delivered a right hook that connected squarely with his jaw. The man fell to his knees, then to his side, and lay on the pavement perfectly still. Not slowing her attack, Gloria spun around to face the black man. The sound of shattering glass pierced her ears. The man had gotten through. The boy screeched in terror. Gloria ran to her children's assailant and jumped on his back. She hammered away at him with her fists, hitting the back of his neck and the top of his head. The man shrugged her off. She fell to the ground and bruised her tailbone. He swung open the car door and grabbed the boys, Keith by the arm, Alex by the neck of his shirt. More screaming. Gloria stood. A jolt of white-hot pain pierced the back of her head. She saw stars and fell back down. She woke up to the sensation of water dripping across her forehead. Focusing her eyes, Gloria saw an old native woman leaning over her, dabbing a cold, wet rag above her eyebrows. She sat up, immediately running her fingers along the back of her head. It was tender and sore. Luckily, a bump hadn't formed. She looked at the woman. The woman smiled back, forming creases of skin in her cheeks. Gloria stared at her, then took a moment to take in her surroundings. Like recalling a dream, she remembered her fight with the squeegee man and the other fellow. The attack on her boys, her bruised tailbone, the black man. Did he take Alex and Keith? Gloria stood up and with a start. "Where's my boys?" she exclaimed, grabbing the old woman by the shoulders. The native woman didn't respond. "Tell me." The woman smiled again and pointed across the street to the alley opposite them. Deep within it, Gloria saw an old, abandoned movie theater. She ran toward it. Gloria slowed her steps and cautiously proceeded toward the entrance marked by an old revolving door. She looked around and made sure she was alone. The last thing she needed was another run-in with a squeegee man or black man, or anyone else for that matter. Fortunately, the coast was clear. There was nothing but the silence of a garbage bin, some cardboard boxes, and a few shards of ragged clothing that littered the street. She went to move towards the door when a short, stubby man jumped out of the garbage bin and landed on her shoulders, forcing her to ground. The fellow's weight was incredible. She assumed he weighed at least 60 to 70 more pounds than he was supposed to. Gloria pressed her palms to the gritty cement beneath her and pushed as if doing a push-up. The beggar, bum, whatever he was, jerked his weight and forced her down again. Her face slammed into the pavement, her nostrils getting a nose full of old, muddy water mixed with fresh spurts of blood. In a fit of vengeance, she pushed up again, this time rolling onto her back, squashing her assailant. She freed herself from his grip and got to her feet. Turning around, she looked down at him. He stared back at her from beneath the hood of his filthy, tan-colored coat. His eyes were washed with innocence, his lips pursed as if in apologize. As if to say, "I'm sorry, I didn't know any better." "Yeah, right." Giving no sympathy, Gloria gave him a swift kick between the legs, the sharp toe of her shoe landing decisively between privates and rectum. The short man yelped an awful shriek that sounded like an old bus screeching to a stop. Leaving him to writhe in agony, Gloria bolted for the revolving door. She pressed into it, followed its spin, and fell to her knees from the momentum of her speed and the door pushing her from behind. It took her a moment to slow her breathing and heart rate down. With a trembling hand, she wiped a slick film of sweat off her forehead. It was hard to put everything into words. Her mother and instinct banged on the door of her mind, as if having a voice all its own, repeating the same stanza over and over. "Alex and Keith, Alex and Keith, Alex and Keith, Alex and Keith." Except there were no words, only feelings and images of her kids. She stood and stepped further into the theater. The lobby was dim, with no lights visible. The only illumination was a misty gray ray of light seeping through the fogged windows of the revolving door. A ticket booth was in front of her, and a little beyond that, a concession stand. On either side of the concession stand were aisles, which she assumed led into the rest of the theater. She slowly moved forward. "Alex? Keith?" Amazingly, her voice did not echo, instead seeming to be absorbed by the darkness. "Just go slow," she told herself. She had been passing the ticket booth when it suddenly lit up. The scorching light pierced her eyes, and once they had focused, Gloria screamed. Staring back at her was a grotesque, zombified man in a tuxedo, running his twig-like fingers along the smooth inside of the booth. Gloria tried to run, but couldn't. Her shoes were stuck to the floor. Each struggle to pull her feet out only caused the laces to grow tighter until her feet were nothing but pins and needles. "You cannot enter without a ticket," the zombie stated as a matter-of-factly. Gloria swallowed what felt like the pit of a plum. "Come closer. Buy a ticket." "It's all right. You must have a ticket to enter. Please, we haven't had business in so long." She looked toward the concession stand, half expecting to see somebody like the zombie man there, but was relieved when there was nobody. Her boys were somewhere inside, and no one outside the theater seemed to want to help. Anyone outside just wanted to hurt her and her kids. Gloria faced the zombie and mustered up the strength to get a ticket. She approached the glass, expecting the monster to squeak. There was silence for several moments. Then the zombie growled, "Aren't you going to say, 1, please?" "What?" was all Gloria could ask herself. Then she understood. It was only polite to ask for a ticket, then to expect it. "1, please," she said. Hoping not to be asked for any form of payment, Gloria watched as the zombie rang the ticket into an old cash register on the counter beside him, his decaying fingers crudely banging on the web-covered keys. The price of the ticket rang up. The cash register displayed XXX dollars. Gloria furrowed her brow. The zombie printed out her ticket and slid it across an opening in the glass. When she went to grab it, he pulled it away. "Here it comes," she thought. "How much could it possibly be?" "The ticket is on the house tonight, Life Girl. You have already made it up to us," he said, a grin sweeping across his face and displaying his shriveled gums. Gloria snatched the ticket and pounded against the glass with her fists. "My boys, what have you done with them? What the—" The booth grew dark and the zombie was gone. She looked at the ticket in her hand. The top of it read, "Welcome to the Theater of Skulls. We appreciate your business." Then below that was a photograph of a skull with deep, foreboding eyes and a pentagram carved into its forehead. Underneath the skull it said, "Enjoy the show. You're in theater number 6, 6th row, 6th seat. Thank you once again for coming to the Theater of Skulls. Be sure to pop by our concession stand." She dropped the ticket in disgust, then picked it back up again. She scanned it once more and walked over to where, forming out of nothingness, a female ticket taker stood. She was robed in an almost transparent white gown, her eyes dark. At this point, Gloria was running on instinct, the instinct to save her boys. She walked to the ticket taker, her hand outstretched, offering her ticket. The ticket was removed from her hand by white fingers with red painted nails. Gloria noticed how stark white the ticket taker was. Aside from her eyes, everything was white. The only hint of color was in her long, wavy hair, a pallid yellow. The ticket taker ripped the ticket in half and handed Gloria the stub. The other half was eaten. Gloria held the ticket in complete bewilderment. The ticket taker smiled and pointed in the direction of theater number 6. Gloria dropped her half of the ticket and ran down the corridor. From behind, a light from a concession stand flashed on. Thinking maybe her boys would be there, she turned toward it, acknowledging that, like the zombie before, the ticket taker had also vanished. The moment she approached the concession counter, Gloria lurched forward, head between her legs, and threw up. On display in the hot dog roaster, rotating smoothly as they cooked, were sizzling plump fingers, their nails charred and crisp. Beside that, the popcorn machine popped teeth, and beside that was a smoothie machine. Through the little circular windows where the slush turned and mixed was a combination of blood and guts, a murky red soup with streaks of swirling beige. Spitting out the remnants of throw-up, Gloria wiped her mouth and stood. She was lightheaded. She yelped again and went to throw up one more time. She couldn't. Her stomach was empty. She gagged a few times, her stomach finally settling. Sitting on the counter, taking on the role of a concession employee, was a human head next to the cash register. It was the head of a bald little boy, his skin dark with dirt, his face partially decayed. "Don't be sick. You should have a snack," he told her with an apparent sense of compassion. "The smoothies are especially nice. They are made from the fluid of life." Gloria didn't say anything and ran back down the corridor, pretending the encounter with the boy never happened. Behind her, she heard the boy laugh and tell her that the finger dogs were ready. "Come on, have some. Come on, eat, eat, eat." Her stride didn't break, and she didn't bother to look back to see if the concession stand, too, would shut down after she had visited there. A few feet ahead of her, a sign lit up an ominous red. Theater number 6. Now showing The Dismemberment of Alex and Keith. Panicking, she threw the theater door open and screamed her son's name in the vast cinema. It was empty and surprisingly clean. The walls, seats, and curtains were all the color of brown brick. Everything was quiet. Gloria looked around and was jolted back to the attention of the screen when the curtain began to open, sliding and squeaking along its rail. A bright beam of light hit the screen as the projector started rolling. The screen counted down in Roman numerals. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and white text displayed against a black background. "Hello, Gloria Ryler. Welcome to the Dismemberment of Alex and Keith." The letters then dripped with white blood and faded away. The story began and was in black and white. She saw her children. Both her boys were in a dark laboratory, lying side by side on an operating table. Their hands and feet were tied to a crudely designed device of some sort at the foot of the table. Gloria turned toward the projection booth. It was nothing but shadows and the bright beam of light from the projector blasting forth and hitting the screen. Her boys. "Alex! Keith!" she yelled and ran up to the screen. She pressed against it, thinking her boys were on the other side. The canvas only rocked with each press. "Stop!" she cried, sticking her hand out in protest. Nothing but the blinding white light of the projector replied back. It didn't appear anyone was running the machine. She faced the screen again. A doctor entered the laboratory. Her gleaming white coat clashed with the black outfit she wore underneath. Her hair was dark with white streak throughout. The doctor's eyes hid behind a pair of square bifocals. Tears swelled in Gloria's eyes, and she found herself helplessly watching the screen. She didn't know what to do or even what was happening anymore. The doctor on screen was tauntingly began rotating the handle on an activated device. A knowing grin beamed from the doctor's face. She would turn the handle a little, stop, then, with the sleeve of her lab coat, wipe the tears from each of the boys' eyes. Gloria saw her children screaming, but she couldn't hear them. A silent movie. The doctor turned the handle some more, stopped, and this time stroked each of the boys' foreheads as if comforting them. She turned the handle again, then again, then again. Gloria could almost hear her boys screech in pain and terror despite the silence of the film. She cried out, but the evil doctor kept turning the handle, watching first as Alex and then Keith began to be pulled apart. Their arms were the first to detach with a gush of black blood, then their legs, the flesh, tearing like wet cardboard. The doctor turned the handle in a frenzy, torsos spurt with blood, their entrails hanging out like strands of a sopping and muddy mop. The blood rushed at first, then slowed to a glossy ooze, bathing the table and dripping to the floor. The doctor stopped and looked at Gloria. She motioned with her finger for Gloria to come closer. Speechless, Gloria ebbed herself away from the screen. That's when the doctor stepped out of the film and grabbed her. All right, welcome to the story behind the story time. So for that particular one, see, that particular story is an older story. I'll give that that. First, the collection we're reading from is older in general, but the story itself is even before that because it was published through an anthology. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it was during a time in my writing career where I was basically thickly involved with the horror community and the horror writers and publishers and all the rest. And so there is often anthologies. And again, this is before like the big publishing boom. This is before all that stuff. We're talking, you know, roughly mid-2000s. And so, yeah, there's all these anthologies always happening, and there's always these invitations. And, you know, this is back too where a lot of writers who are starting out, you know, we're working for free. I don't think I even got paid for this story other than my contributor's copy. And of course, that habit's not in place anymore, but that's how it was back then. But anyway, yeah, so we were challenged to write out like a horror story. And, you know, the funny thing about writing is like, I don't really have an answer as to why I wrote that particular story for this segment, unfortunately, unlike the other segments that we do. What I do know, though, is upon reading it, I can clearly see the Stephen King influence. Because, you know, like all good horror writers, you read some Stephen King, right? So, yeah, I could. And Steve, you know, when I read his stuff, as I started out as a writer, he was also indirectly teaching me, because I would pay attention to how he was making the sentences, how he was forming paragraphs, creating mood, you know, bizarre ideas, stuff like that, right? And it helped me, one, partly learn the craft, but two, it gave me kind of this, and I mean, I'm coming at this naive at this particular stage in my career, right? So it gave me sort of like this permission to just go wild with the imagination. You know what I mean? Like nothing's off limits, even if it's weird, bizarre, kind of like, you know, in dreams where things make sense, but then when you wake up and look back, you're like, that makes zero sense. It's kind of like, you know, it's elements like that you could take and you can make stories out of. And for me, it was a very freeing realization. It was a very freeing even experience to recognize that I could let my imagination do whatever it wanted. And as long as I made it into some sort of coherent narrative that made sense in the context of that narrative, then the sky was the limit, because that's the beauty of suspension of disbelief, right? That you can create any circumstance out of anything, no matter how ridiculous or outrageous, and yet you'll believe it. I mean, so that's what that story was about for me. It was kind of a way to exercise the imagination. And then, of course, too, at that particular stage, I was very, very keen on making a name for myself in the context of ideas. I wanted to be the guy who, and I'm not saying I'm successful at this, but what I am saying is my goal was to be the guy who could come up with something that was different, or something that was unique, or something that was just a new spin on an old thing. And, you know, I thought I achieved that with that story. In hindsight now, of course, I recognize there's nothing new under the sun there, in a way, but at the time that was the goal. But I also want to say too, that should be the goal of any writer, right? We should be approaching stories as best we can with the skill set that we have, and try to do something new, try to do something unique, try to do something original. And, you know, there is the truth that there is no such thing as a completely original idea, because basically everything under the sun has been thought of. But what you can do is take, you know, different ideas, combine them, mix them, adjust them, tweak them, strip them, add to them, whatever, and then eventually you do have something new. So that's sort of the goal with any writer, is when it comes to stories, especially where you're asked to do like a horror story, you need to come up with something unique. You need to create a mood. You need to create visuals. You need to get the reader into that realm. And so I'm hoping, as you listen to that story that we just did, Theater of Skulls, that at least for that time that you were listening, that you believed what I was saying, that you were there, and that you experienced what Gloria was experiencing. And that being the case, if I did that for you, awesome. If I didn't, I apologize. I'm sorry. That was a young writer's work. So we'll blame that guy. We'll blame the old guy. And actually, we could blame him, because your body renews itself every 10 years or so. So therefore, literally speaking, a completely different person wrote that story. So there, I remove myself from responsibility. Ha ha ha. Anyway, that's basically the story behind the story. And I hope you found it amusing. And we're going to be back next week with another story, with another story behind the story. So we'll see you then. Take care. Thank you. Thanks for sticking around till after the credits. And this little segment, I want to stick up for our ancestors. I'm talking our ancestors from a long time ago, long, long time ago. And the reason I want to stick up for them is this, okay? We're extraordinarily arrogant in our society today. We think we're technologically advanced, that we got science by the fingertips, that we know more or less everything there is to know about the human body or how the cosmos works. Yeah, we admit there's mysteries and yada, 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 but oh, we got the science to figure it out, or oh, we're close to the edge of a breakthrough, therefore we're gonna figure it out. Therefore, we know everything and we're so smart, ha, ha, ha. And our ancestors were dumb primitives. And you know what? That's 100% crap, okay? If you've done your history research, if you've done archaeological research, there is extraordinary evidence that our ancestors, we're talking like thousands of years back and even beyond that point, were a lot smarter than we were. They had stuff that makes our tech look like child's play. You know, they had ways of thinking that only our best philosophers and scientists can think. These guys were advanced. They weren't people walking around with bows and arrows and rubbing sticks together for fire all the time for like thousands and thousands of years, you know, hunting and gathering. No. There is a lot of stuff. And as proven by the geological record of the Earth and all the rest that goes with it, we've had, I think it's 7 or 8 significant extinction events occur throughout Earth's history, right? So prior to these events, we had civilizations, we had people. You know, the Earth wasn't just blank, you know, in terms of humanoids. And so to think that us as a society are so advanced and our ancestors are idiots, I'm like, no, that's 100% not true, right? Yeah, our ancestors had these sort of stopping points and had to kind of start over, you know, for whoever might have survived these cataclysmic items. But the point is that they weren't dumb and we should show them some respect. And if you want to even get deeper and a little bit more heartfelt, look back down the line. Those people are your family, so talk nice, right? Okay, anyway, and I want to make one little point about that too, okay, and then I'll wrap it up. And the point about that is this: the Ark of the Covenant in the Bible, its construction as outlined in the Bible confirms that the thing was radioactive, and we all chalk that up to it's a fairy tale. No, the composition of the thing made it radioactive. We have other ancient texts from other sources and other cultures that describe different devices, that describe different items, right? And we talk about, oh, those are stories from a long time ago. No, these are records of things that happened, and these are records of people who knew stuff, all going back to my point that our ancestors weren't stupid. So that being said, let's maybe humble down a little bit and realize that we have a very strong background of very smart people, and all we need to do is a little bit of digging, a little bit of reading, and we can learn something from those who lived before us a long, long time ago. And that's what that's about, right? Because a writer's job is to tell the truth or point people to it. You know, fiction writers always say, ha, I make a living by lying to people. I'm like, no, you don't. You sure you're telling a fiction story, but look, be objective. Everything that's in your book, it goes to write what is the classic phrase, write what you know. You can't write what you don't know. If you don't know, you don't know, meaning there's no access to that information. There's nothing there. So you are writing what you know. You are being autobiographical. You are putting your own biases into it. You know, you're doing all this sort of stuff. You're including real world events sometimes. You're including real world locations. You're not lying to the reader. You're just taking them through basically a narrative through nonfiction, you know, just in a way that they could understand it. Like, that's all fiction is. Like, it's a commentary. Anyway, that's a separate discussion. Maybe I'll do an AuthorTube video on it. But the point is, all right, this segment's getting a little bit long. We're going to cut it off. Tune in next week. Okay, we're reading from Magic Man plus 15 Tales of Terror. Please support the book if you can, please. And otherwise, we'll see you next week for a new podcast of the Realm of Heroes and Monsters Storytime with me, your jackass host, AP Fuchs. See you then.